Of course, that has to be the sequel that we go to after we've actually had Lorry Ladies. Clearly, Lady Balloonists would be another little sequel, which I'm sure we could make a wonderful movie out of. But perhaps not as wonderful as the Our Lives documentary, Lorry Ladies, produced, of course, by Niamh O'Donnell, with the amazing Angela Rippon hosting it. And it was awesome, Angela. Well done. Welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
I'm extremely well, thanks, Alex. How are all of you?
We're okay. Introductions. Tessa Snott back with us again after graduating with a first class honours in journalism.
Oh, well, congratulations. Oh,
thank you. Lovely to speak to you as well.
And currently employed as a graduate as well, doing wonderful sort of networking material as well. So that's all great news from that point of view. And we also have the wonderful Graham Lloyd, broadcaster and writer, sports commentator and investigative journalist, it has to be said now, with a tale which I think even Angela Rippon would find quite awesome. Bearing in mind the six celebrities so far who have endorsed your Seeking of the Truth with Christie's are the Prime Minister, Theresa May.
Yeah.
Sir Tim Rice.
Yeah.
He's forgotten the other four. Who are the other four that we've actually got here?
Rory Bremner.
Geoffrey Archer, of course.
Geoffrey Archer, Rory Bremner, Paddy Ashdown and David Gower, the former England cricket captain. But I suppose that the big question is, are you a fan of cricket, Angela?
Well, now, you see, that's a very moot point because I'm a member of the Lords Taverners,
which is
the charity based at Lords Cricket Ground. And in fact, for 5 years, I was president of the Lady Taverners.
Oh, right.
So I've seen a bit of cricket in my time, but I have to say it's not the first sporting event I would choose to go to. I would put tennis and rugby ahead of it, I think.
Well, it's interesting rugby. I thought it might have been eventing, actually, but no, it's very good. Having said that, Angela, and I suspect, actually, Angela might have been just a mere enfant when 1968 went round the corner and Sir Gary Sobers actually hit six sixes off the one ball. Do you remember that sort of piece of sporting history 50 years ago?
Yes. I remember it. Well, 50 years, yes, I do. I remember it being reported because I was a young reporter. Well, I'm reporting
there we are.
At the time.
Exactly.
So I remember it happening.
And
thankfully,
the BBC actually kept recording.
Absolutely.
Which actually helped your evidence, Graham.
It was. It was an iconic moment. In 1968, he hit the six sixes, Angela, and it had never been done before. Six sixes off six balls. And I've written a book which proves that the ball that was sold by Christie's in 2006 is not the real deal because it's the wrong make.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the BBC Wales footage, which was recorded quite by chance 50 years ago, is a key part of my evidence. And
who's got the real ball, then?
We don't know where the real ball is. It was put into Gary Sobers' cricket bag, and then when he went back from Swansea to Nottingham in 1968, we think he pulled out the wrong ball. And suddenly this ball made by Duke and Son became the six sixes ball, which should have been made by Stuart Surridge. And I'm in the process of trying to prove that the ball is not the real deal. I'm trying to get Christie's now to change their minds and admit that they made a mistake in 2006. So it's not really about cricket at all. It's about a cricket ball, and it's all about human nature. Because
and a lot of detective work. As
absolutely.
Well,
I felt a bit like the TV detective Columbo, minus the shabby raincoat.
You see, you may say Columbo. I was thinking The Baron, an ITC series back in the day, really, or possibly even Lovejoy. But no, you obviously
Columbo. Lovejoy was a wonderful, and of course he was to do with antiques. Mm. And a lot of this, well, some of this book is about what goes on in auction houses, which I find quite fascinating, as I think you do as well, don't you, Angela?
Well, yes, because I've made several television
That's
programs
right.
that involve antiques. I've presented the Antiques Roadshow for 3 years.
Absolutely.
In fact, I think I was the first. Yes, I was indeed. I think the first national presenter of the Antiques Roadshow.
Another first. See, first presenter
and
of
television. Well, yes, I've also we did. Cash in the Attic. Which
That's right.
We spent a lot of time in antique. But I tell you what strikes me about your story, Graham, is never mind the auction house. What about the person who paid whatever the figure was for the ball when they bought it at auction? How do they feel about that?
Well,
presumably paid a lot of money
for
something which is not the real
thing. This, Angela, is a saga in itself.
Absolutely. I'll keep it brief. The man who bought it for $26,400 was was putting together a sort of collection of sporting memorabilia. And he lives in Mumbai in India, and the ball was transported to him about a year after the auction, and he was having financial problems, so it was impounded by the airport authorities because he couldn't pay the import tax on it. And then it was sold again to another Indian in an online auction, and for about £900, and he tried to sell it back to the man who'd paid £26,400 for it. What I wanted to ask you, though, Angela, is how much importance is placed on a certificate of provenance signed by somebody important? In this case, signed by the man who hit the ball, because from my experience, that seems to blow everything else out of the water. Is that a fair comment?
Well, it should do. And funnily enough, I was talking to Luke Skywalker himself about this not too long ago for Rip Off Britain, when we were talking about, he had discovered, Mark Hamill, of course, we're talking about the actor, had discovered that, and in fact he started a class action in California against those people who forged the signatures or the memorabilia belonging to famous people. I did an interview with him in which he said anyone can go onto his website if they've got a Mark Hamill autograph, and he will tell them whether or not it is the real thing, because he is fed up with and angry on behalf of those people who, like the man who bought the cricket ball, spend hundreds, very often thousands of pounds on things which they think are genuine, only to discover that they are fakes or not the real thing for one reason or another. And he puts great store by provenance, as indeed do I, because if you've got a signed declaration which says Joe Bloggins really did own this picture or really did own this piece of antique, or I really was the person who held this cricket bat or held this cricket ball, then you go a long way down the road to proving that actually it is the genuine article, and it really should carry, as a letter of providence, quite a heavy weight, I think.
But if you had
that, it's the genuine thing.
But if you were in the sporting memorabilia department and this ball came in with a signed certificate of providence saying this is the ball that I hit during the 660s.
To be precise, I, Sir Garfield Sobers, confirm that this signed cricket ball was bowled during the overs in which I hit 6 sixes off Malcolm Nash at the county championship match at the St Helens Ground, Swansea, in 1968, signed Sir Garfield Sobers.
So I'm saying,
well,
Angela,
the letter itself, actually, is probably worth quite a bit, actually.
Yes, but is there one other person that you, as a responsible sporting memorabilia expert, would have thought, well, just to confirm that this is the ball, we ought to contact him?
Yes.
It would be who?
Gary Sobers.
You would contact Gary Sobers.
You would contact Gary Sobers, but what about the other person involved in this? The man who bowled the ball?
Malcolm Nash.
And did...
Nobody contacted Malcolm Nash.
And that's really the point, Angela. Had they taken the time to make one phone call and rung Malcolm Nash and said, what was the make of the ball that you bowled to Gary Sobers? Malcolm Nash would have said, it was a Stuart Surridge. And they would have said, we are selling a Duke and Son. And he would have said, well, that ain't the ball. And the fact is, they didn't.
They didn't check.
They didn't check.
I suppose what you can say is that Sir Gary clearly believed that it was the ball.
He did.
He probably did whatever he did and said whatever he said and wrote in good faith.
Absolutely. Absolutely,
Angela. And as I say, even the letter itself, I would think, would be worth quite a bit because if it's signed by him.
But what happens when...
The signature alone would be worth... But good... I'm not an antique dealer. I don't work in the industry. I am not an expert.
I know you're not an expert.
I'm just giving you a personal opinion.
I know you're not an expert, but I'd like to know is... If there is so much evidence, and there's a mountain of evidence, and there's perhaps some new evidence that proves the case that the ball is not the ball, what do auction houses do in the sense that if they say, oh, yes, we made a mistake, might it just open the floodgates for other people to say, well, I'm not sure that this is the real thing? Or do they actually fess up and say...
If you've done your research, you'll know that this is not the only case where an auction house has made a mistake. And in each case, they do then go to great lengths to check the provenance. And where possible, if they have made a genuine mistake, and it's proven that they have, they do make reparation. But, you know, that's for the individual auction houses to give you an answer to, not a layman like me.
No.
You will find that there are many, many precedents set where this is concerned, where someone has sold or bought something in good faith, believing it to be the genuine article, only to discover that it isn't.
Yeah. We are lay people together, you and me, Angela, because I've spent a lot of time investigating this, but I'm reaching a crucial stage now where I'm having to go back to Christie's and say, look, I would like you to have a look at more evidence and revisit the sale of this ball.
It certainly will make for very interesting viewing of Testnet Special when you're actually featured on that.
And also, remember, you're dealing with a highly reputable company.
Yeah.
They have a reputation to maintain.
Yeah.
It's not likely that they will not listen to what you have to say and take it very seriously.
I would hope so.
Look into it.
In fact,
I'm sure they will.
It's a whole new world. We'll leave it for the moment, Angela, because I want to move into the descriptor for Monday, a few weeks ago, when in this Our Lives documentary, Angela Rippon, who was the first host of Top Gear, visits Northern Ireland to meet the women who live their lives on the open road behind the wheel of a truck. Not content with just driving for a living, these lorry ladies spend their weekends at truck festivals across the country competing for prizes with their huge vehicles. Angela, when you got behind that vehicle, I must admit, I thought, what is she doing? But you drove it, you held it together. It was amazing.
It's not the first time I've driven a lorry.
But an articulated lorry. Yes. I mean, that's whoa.
When I was presenting Top Gear, I did drive a lorry with a trailer on the back of it. And I actually drove it on a section of motorway that was about, I think from memory, it was the M62, which was not actually open to the public. It was a week away from being officially opened by the then Minister of Transport. And so I was able to drive on it without having to have an HGV license, and I physically drove it on a motorway. And I remember then that they were very, very easy to drive. You know, it's, they weigh a ton, but they don't weigh a ton on the wheel, because they're all power assisted, and they're very, very easy to, well, once you get used to the length of the darn things, then you know, they're actually relatively simple to drive. And I think in the documentary, when one of the girls pulled up at the truck fair, I mean, I said to her, you know, you parked that like it was a million. She said, well, you know, to me it is, because that's how easy they are to drive.
I've just got five words: in your dreams, Jeremy Clarkson, in your dreams. So on that.
Well, you know and I know, Alex, as we had this conversation before, that the Clarkson team did a very different program from the Top Gear that I presented. It was much more of a journalistic motoring program when I did it than Toys for the Boys, which is what Clarkson and Co.
Indeed.
It was a different program, yeah.
Tessa, as somebody who commutes regularly now from the joys of Peterborough up to Lincoln, ever considered an articulated lorry?
Well, I might invest in one. They're quite spectacular these days, aren't they, with beds and microwaves.
Some of the language that was being used by Andrew to just, when she steps in, and say, it's like a tart's bedroom.
the thing is, there is a practical reason for this, of course, because so many long-distance lorry drivers do have to, I suppose for financial, but mainly for security reasons, actually live in their cab.
Yeah.
So they are kitted out, you know, with very highly sophisticated security systems, but with a bed, with a television, with a microwave.
Yes.
They've got the whole nine yards there. They live in them, so they have to be very comfortable for them.
Well, they're kind of house on wheels, aren't they?
They are, yes.
It's interesting, in terms of, obviously it was focused on Truckfest in Northern Ireland. Do you think the thing is crossing over this side of the Atlantic? Are we getting more women drivers in England, Scotland, Wales, and so on?
Oh, no. I mean, we concentrated on Northern Ireland because I was making the programme initially for the BBC in Northern Ireland. But in fact, I mean, there are women lorry drivers, not just all over the United Kingdom, but all over Europe as well. The thing is that they're a vital part of the industry now, because one of the guys from the main lorry drivers union was telling me that they have a shortage of lorry drivers, of long-distance lorry drivers, and that actually the women are now a vital part of the workforce. And you'll find them not just in Northern Ireland, but all over the United Kingdom, all over Europe, and also those truck festivals are held all over Europe.
Yeah.
And my goodness, they spend a fortune on those trucks and take such pride in them. It's wonderful.
I think a fortune in car wax alone in some of the areas there. This is pristine.
Yeah. They do a Peterborough truck fest. I've been several years in a row. It's brilliant.
It's wonderful. You've got your Michael Jacksons, you've got your all sorts of images from that point of view. Of the ones that we actually saw and that we saw on camera, Angela, which was your personal favourite?
I did actually like the one that won, the Tarts Bedroom, because it was, she was
overwhelmed. Really I got the sense that she was actually overwhelmed when she won, really. But
she was,
wonderful sense of jeopardy that you put into place, saying they've all gone to male people so far. They've all been men winners from that point of view. And then finally, you get a bit of a redress of the balance.
Except I have to tell you, Alex, that at least two of the guys who came out to collect their prizes, it was their daughters in one case and their wife in another case who has actually done the cleaning of the truck.
Oh.
Well, it is Northern Ireland. Sorry.
Was there a competition involved in the documentary, or is this separate?
No, it was a mixture of both.
Mixture of both.
I think
it was
well put together, and I think it should be BAFTA award winning. Personally,
I'd like to watch it.
I think Royal Television Society. Yeah. I think Des Henderson should put it in for it. Should be go there. It's very rare that I watch live terrestrial television these days, but I felt I had to support Andrew. I watched it. I was very impressed with it.
It's very interesting.
Stuff.
It is. I mean, I watch a lot of the Ice Road Truckers and the Outback Truckers. I think it's brilliant. Oh. So this is it's fantastic.
Excellent. So what? What's next, Angela? I mean, we spoke recently to Gloria Honeyfoot about a variety of other bits and pieces. What else are you getting up to?
Well, two important things, actually. First of all, you mentioned Glow, and of course she and I and our colleague Julia Somerville are just right at the moment, actually, in the middle of filming for the next series of Rip Off Britain, which goes out in September, and then we have a week of live programmes in October, before we then all head off to do Rip Off Britain travel. So there's that coming up with the three of us working together on those programmes. We do about 60 of them a year now for Rip Off Britain. But the other major programme that I've been working on, which in fact just today I got the final sort of heads up on it that I can now go in the studio and record the commentary for it, is an hour-long special documentary for BBC One Primetime called The Truth About Antibiotics. And I've been working on this for over a year now, looking at the problem, which is that we've had no new antibiotics for almost 40 years, and unfortunately bacteria are very clever little organisms.
They evolve.
The oldest living thing on the planet. Well. They evolve. They are now becoming so resistant to all the main antibiotics that we have.
We're all going to die.
Well, we're not actually all going to die, no, because there's an awful lot of research being done into how we're going to find new antibiotics. And I've made a whole documentary about the research that's being done, why this is happening, why the bacteria have got to the stage where they are resistant to most antibiotics. Took me to Texas, where I went alligator hunting with a professor who is looking into alligator blood, which he believes has a very important antibiotic in it. And in fact, most of the antibiotics that we're going to find, the new ones, will come from the natural world, because when you think about it, if the natural world, if every creature in the natural world hadn't developed their own antibiotic system, there would be nothing left on the earth. Everything would have been wiped out because the bacteria would have reigned supreme. But it's been absolutely fascinating, and I hope that you will find the film that way too.
Angela, it's not a case of hope. Hope doesn't come into it. I know we'll find the film interesting. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It's just a win-win situation. It's like sort of when I read How's That, the Six Sixers Ball Mystery by Graham Lloyd. I read at the end of it, I thought, yeah, that works. So total trust in Graham, total trust in yourself. Tessa, would you like to put those last two questions to Angela Rippon, please?
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us this evening?
As always, Tessa, I have really enjoyed talking to Alex and the rest of his studio guests.
I'm glad.
Splendid stuff.
And will you be returning to the show in the near future?
Well, if I'm asked,
I think you will be.
Absolutely essential. We have just heard from Jean Bruce Scott over in San Diego, in San Diego State University, fascinated by the cricket story. We're going to speak to Jean and Randy in a matter of moments from now. A round of applause for Angela Rippon, please.
Lovely to meet you. Oh, I'll speak to you.
And you too, guys. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Chasing down the days of fear, chasing down a dream before it disappeared. I was aching to be somewhere near. Your voice was all I heard. I was shaking from a storm in me, haunted by the specters that we had to see. Yeah, I wanted to be the melody above the noise, above the hurt. I was young, not dumb, just wishing to be blinded by you, brand new, and we were pilgrims on our way. I woke up at the moment when the miracle occurred, heard a song that made some sense out of the world.
Well, that'd be you too, doing their stuff with the Miracle of Joey Ramone. Meanwhile, with something completely different.
Californian sunshine, Native American joy, and the finest Airwolf helicopter pilot and Magnum PI naval officer ever. It's Gene Bruce Scott, now live on the Midweek Drive for Siren 107.3 FM.
Yay, Gene Bruce Scott was gone, she's gone. The line is good. Oh, honestly, sometimes you get those Californian links together and whoosh, it's all gone particularly peculiar. Okay, no worries. Let's go to Plan B, which is Tessa. Would you like to talk to us a little bit about the Lightbox? Or indeed, your thoughts on the Chuckle Brothers. You've got a choice there. Where do you wish to sort of send
the Lightbox? Come on.
The Lightbox?
We want to hear
okay,
the Lightbox.
Okay, we'll go.
What is the Lightbox and why? We know you've won it in a competition,
yes.
But why did you want to win it and what does it do?
Okay, so this competition was by the Sleepyhead Clinic. And this lamp, it's called a Lumi light alarm. And it's basically supposed to help you sleep, help your mind. So basically the Lumi body clock wakes you naturally with a sunrise, Waking with light has been shown to improve mood, energy, productivity and the quality of sleep and awakening. Now, I've always struggled with my sleeping patterns since I was very little. And I thought, wow, this is, you know, I was on Siren. I thought I'll just, you know, apply or do, enter the competition, not thinking I'd win. And I did. And
so how come you won it? Just by chance?
Just by chance, I believe. I don't, you know, I know, a midweek drivette, but I did win. And it's been put to good use, definitely. Right. I've already set it up. It sits
it's
there on
working,
my bedside table.
It's winning. The magic is there. And just mentioning the joys of Sleepy Hen Clinic means we can hopefully connect now with Jean Bruce Scott and Randy Reinholtz. Yay! Whoa, yes.
Hello.
For the first time in many, many moons, we're all set to actually come to them and then suddenly, oh, the line had dropped. It is, never mind. Jean, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. We'll come to you first if we may. I'll introduce you to the two fine folk who are with us, Tessa Snart and, of course, the wonderful author extraordinaire, Graham Lloyd.
Alex, please.
Broadcaster and writer.
Just introduce me as Graham Lloyd, a jobbing journalist.
A jobbing journalist.
He's blushing.
That's all I am.
That's as bad as saying Randy Reinholtz is merely an actor and co-founder of Native Voices. He's not. He's a professor. Just wonderful. Anyway, we'll come to Randy in a few seconds. Jean, you're fascinated by cricket, I believe.
I am. I just heard the most wonderful story about a small town in Texas. I think it's called Prairie View. And there, they've got someone there named Tanweer Ahmed, who is a Pakistani immigrant. And he's building his dream project, which is going to be the largest cricket stadium in the United States.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, so he's going to have a field, he's going to have a wicket in, he's going to have a pavilion.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He's going to have everything.
Oh, I'm not sure a pavilion will be.
No, it's supposedly quite large, and it's right off the highway because he wants everyone to see it and get more interested in cricket, and this small town is now edging out football and baseball.
Really?
This is the shock, of course, because as I said when I emailed Randy earlier in the day, I thought, you know, they might be interested in this, might have some sort of interest, but surely it's more baseball, really. Although maybe the Choctaw Indian scenario, maybe actually cricket would have been a thing back in the day, really. That's interesting. Actually, Randy, I have to say the Choctaw were given another name check in another new series that I was catching yesterday called Cloak and Dagger, in which we had a reference to the Choctaw Native Americans who were actually part of New Orleans. Sure, that's interesting. So the word is getting out there, slowly but surely.
And the Irish built a nice commemorative monument to the time when Choctaw gave money to the Irish during the potato famine when the U.S. government turned its back.
You see, the magic is there. But as we actually have the two co-founders of Native Voices online at present, I'm going to actually put them in the role of critics, basically, dramatic critics, etc., because I'm going to, without the aid of a safety net, together with the awesome Graham Lloyd, read a little piece of poetry that Graham actually produced called Trumpery Trumpety Trump. I think we know where we're going with this one. We have a sense about where we're actually going. If it's okay, Randy and Jean, you can listen to this. It's just a fairly short series of verses that we come through. We will hopefully deliver it in the positivity that it actually requires. I mean, Graham, would you like to take the first paragraph, or first verse, and I'll do the verses after that?
Just a little bit of background. It was written by me for a poetry competition, the Southport Writers Circle poetry competition, and it came runner-up in the humour section, and it's about it's about Donald Trump's first 100 days in power. It's called Trumpery Trumpety Trump. It was the second seismic shock of 2016, but in the age of the Donald, what does trumpery mean? The commander-in-chief has some trouble with truth, so thesaurus at hand, it's time to play sleuth.
The word comes from tramperie, Middle French for deceit, an adjective and noun linked to tromper, to cheat. It means showy but worthless, delusive and shallow, like a reality TV show, who's politically callow.
It also describes nonsense, rubbish and trash, or just like his tweets, complete balderdash. Trumped up means making up false accusations about Obama and China and the United Nations.
To trump is a verb with more than one meaning. To break wind out loud is rude, almost preening. It can mean to better something or someone. Playing cards, doing deals, they're just games to be won.
Definitions aside, I'm confused and amazed. What should we make of Trump's first 100 days? An unpredictable one-off, his lifestyle so sleazy, his words and his deeds make the world feel uneasy.
It's one take on one day, the opposite the next, leaving both friends and foes aggrieved and perplexed. He flip-flops on most things, from NATO to Putin, and Vlad's his best friend, until he puts the boot in.
President Pinocchio is a maverick man-child, too often too happy to let his emotions run wild. He signs orders, builds walls, and initiates spats. Like a classic Bond villain, he loves to stroke cats.
His barnstorming mantra screams, America first! But the isolationist bubble has quickly been burst. He's a new gung-ho gunslinger, a fraudulent old fart, who shoots from the lip and then acts with his heart.
Can we hope against hope he'll defy expectations and not shake the globe to its very foundations? Is he smart as a cookie or as mad as a hatter? Who knows, but you're fearful when facts fail to matter.
When fake news and gut instinct rank higher than proof, and policy seems to be made up on the hoof, does his strange rictus grin hide a lost wisdom tooth? God bless America. God help us all. Struth!
Bravo!
That was very good.
A runner-up, it should have taken first place.
I couldn't agree more with you.
Well, there we are. Delivered trumpery, trumpety trump. Hopefully I didn't let you down too much.
No, you did a marvellous job.
That was brilliant.
Sight reading from that perspective. And actually, poetry and native voices. Is it something which you... Because obviously lots of plays get made with respect to native voices. What about the sort of native poetry, Randy?
I couldn't follow you there.
No, just like...
a lot of our playwrights were poets first.
Yes.
So Marie Clements, who is very well known in both Canada and the United States, started as a poet. Diane Glancy, Carolyn Dunn. So poetry actually figures pretty heavily in what we work on. In fact, even playwrights today who don't consider themselves poets, like Frank Toss, actually writes some pretty interesting poetry within his texts. Mm. And so, yeah, it's very important.
It all interconnects together. Now, we were speaking earlier, of course, of the Six Sixers. The Six Sixers bore mystery. I sent over one or two things. I mean, I don't know, Randy, did you have a chance to have a little perusal through some of the background material we sent over to your good self with David?
I did.
In which case, what would you like to quiz him about, basically, because he's a fairly amenable soul, and I'm sure he'll deal with all kinds of questions that you may have about the whole sort of sequence.
Oh, gosh, I didn't come up with any questions. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Sometimes...
I'm slow today. I'm totally slow today.
The evidence speaks for itself. That's the important thing. The evidence
exactly.
Speaks for itself, or indeed lack of evidence.
I think the fellow who bought it for the 26,000-plus pounds got taken.
Nice. Good. Well said, Gene.
He got taken for a very, very large amount of money. And
I mean, if that was in Airwolf or Magnum PI, you'd have set Tom Selleck on the case straight away, or at least Jan Michael Vincent. You know, would not have settled for that.
The problem is he earns so much money now that £26,400 is really nothing to him, and he's not really worried about it. And that's the sad thing, that nobody seems to care that the world's most famous cricket ball is not the real deal, apart from me.
I'm sure that the 25,000 cricketers in the United States, if they were to read your book, would agree with you.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, actually, because the man who bowled the ball 50 years ago and who swears that the ball that was bowled is not the ball that was sold is a guy called Malcolm Nash, and he actually went over to America and he coached, and then he went to Canada, and his views were that cricket was catching on in America. I mean, how is it now? Because he's been back in England for quite a few years. How popular is cricket now?
I think it's becoming very popular, and it was, in fact, the first sport in America. You know, they played cricket before they played baseball here.
Oh, really?
And I think, like soccer, although it's a little bit slower in its growth, I think it is catching on, and I would say one of the reasons for that is that it's a fairly civilized game, and there's not a lot of fistfights, and those kinds of things, at least from what I've been reading. I've just now identified the San Diego Cricket Association, and they've got some grounds that are fairly close to our house. So I'm going to get Randy out there, and we're going to go and learn a little bit more about it. One of the reasons that I'm so fascinated about it is because of the East Asian immigrant population.
Yep.
That is actually sort of behind its popularity and its growth.
Yep.
Here in the United States. So it's a really interesting way of for us to talk about how communities are embracing and accepting immigrants, and also the sports that are championed by them. So it's right up my alley as far as personal research and interest.
It has played such an important part in British society over God knows how many years now, sort of more than 200 years. And
yeah.
I always think, my son is a keen cricketer, and he became captain of his local club. And it wasn't so much that he was good at cricket. It actually enabled him to become a much better person, in my view. You know, a lot of the social skills that you learn in organising a team on and off the field, I think it's been a fantastic sport for him. And it's why so many clubs are founded in this country. The problem we've got now is that there are so many other things for young men and women to do that membership of clubs is falling, and so many clubs in this country are just saying, we can't run 2, 3, or 4 teams, we can only run one, because there's so much competition from all the other things. And
oh,
that's very sad.
Goodness.
Very sad.
Yes. Yes.
I think the big shift in the United States as far as people following sports, it seems like sports are all about money.
Yeah.
And the celebrity moment.
Absolutely.
Of who's the greatest.
Yeah.
And the reason my generation enjoyed sport, I'm in my mid-50s, is it was a team activity. It was something to do with other people, and there was something one learned in pursuing the sport that applied to the rest of life.
Absolutely, Randy. That's it in a nutshell. You've summed it up. It's all to do with money. It's all to do with celebrity, and it's very depressing, I have to be honest.
Let's bring in Tessa here. Tessa, are you depressed by this, or is it a case of, no, it's just with us?
Yeah, I think it's very, very sad, and I'd agree with everything that you're both saying. It is all about the money and you know, celebrities, and I think you can say that for everything these days, to be honest. So,
do we know the price of everything but the value of nothing?
Absolutely.
Oh,
that's
there
it
we
in
go.
A nutshell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thankfully, the midweek drive will continue to press those boundaries.
And just remember that the pursuit of money is the root of all evil.
Yes.
Not money
exactly.
is the root of all evil.
Oh,
the pursuit of money is the root of all evil.
See, that's where I've been going wrong then. I've been saying it wrong.
It's
suit. I will remember that.
We unpick all manner of that. As Alice Walker says...
I do have my moments.
It's our only hope. The truth is the only guide. If you are led by a lie, of course you're going to fall off a planet. Sorry, that was for Donald Trump. I just thought I'd put that in there.
Absolutely. Spot on.
Ah. Well, if you can write the colour purple, then surely you should actually have something to say about truth. Randy and Jean, it's been awesome as ever, but far, far, far too short. So we've got to... I know, exactly. Philip Hurdwood to bring on board in a few seconds as well. Randy, are you a Bob Dylan fan at all?
I didn't hear what you said. I'm sorry.
Randy, are you a Bob Dylan fan?
Bob Dylan? Mm. Yeah, I actually just read a Patti Smith memoir that she kept quoting Bob Dylan all the way.
He's been very influential, to be fair.
It's kind of worked away through. Is there any particular Bob Dylan piece of music you'd like us to seek out for you, Randy?
Well, we've been on this wisdom train here. Maybe we're talking about Blowing in the Wind, but
See, that's why Randy is the go-to person when it comes to... Take Phil Lewis, take lots of our other directors, Graham Harper, etc. But if you want to really sort of encapsulate it, Randy Ryan helps you, your go-to man. Last two questions for Randy and Jean, please, Tessa.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
Yes.
He says surprisingly.
I said that a bit quick, didn't I?
Exactly.
And will you return to the show?
Exactly.
Oh, I wanted to say, yes, I have two, and I'm so glad that we have it, because now I'm infatuated with cricket and who plays it here in America.
There we go.
Another convert. You see, we've actually got sufficient midweek drivettes over in Los Angeles and San Diego to actually start putting together a team of cricketers there. I think I'm going to suggest this to Phil and company.
And then we ought to go on tour over there.
Exactly. Yes. This will happen.
Sounds like a good plan.
We'll catch.
We have a good league here. San Diego, we have quite a big league.
We have a couple extra bedrooms. Come on, guys.
Oh, there you go.
We can house the siren team.
Yay!
The roads must a man walk down before you call him a man. How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Isn't how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many years can a mountain exist before it is washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yes, and how many times must a man look up before he can see the sky? Yes, and how many ears must one man have before he can hear people cry? Yes, and how many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
To see that Penny Evans is back listening with us. Yay, go Penny! And I hope that Derbyshire is obviously celebrating not just Penny Evans, but also Keira Osbrook. But in Little London, it's Phil Hurtwood. How are you, Phil?
Hello in Little London. Yes, it's me. It's me. Now, listen, what's that? Who was that singing just now on that track?
That was Robert Zimmerman. You might know him better.
Was it himself?
Yes.
I haven't got a particularly clear line, but it sounded like it was somebody else.
It was the main man.
Little Bobby Zimmerman.
The words of Graham Lloyd. Sorry, very nearly slipped into a David line for that. It's been a long particular production. Long day, actually. Phil Hurtwood, did you ever actually work with the Chuckle Brothers? Or are you saddened by the demise of one of the Chuckle Brothers?
I'm very sorry. They brought a lot of joy and happiness and laughs to a lot of kids. And I think they had a wonderful long career and they did an awful lot for the general public. And yeah, they were great. And I'm sorry that he died. I mean, he apparently had a pretty miserable last year or so of his life,
Following Rotherham, what can you expect, really? I mean, you know, you have Rotherham and they're playing Brentford, they get thrashed 5-1, it's enough to drive you to the grave. Sorry, you might have felt
that. It was a shame. I was sorry to see that. I'm always sorry. I think we're all diminished by when somebody goes, you know, somebody who's an entertainer. I think we're all diminished when they go.
But remember, they're really not gone if we can remember them. And there's always the memories.
Well, there is that. That's a very good point. Yes, indeed. No, you're quite right.
And
speaking
of memories,
they live on in our memories. Yes.
I like to feel we carve out some memories every single week of the Midweek Drive.
We do. You are a walking memorabilia. You are a... a Republican.
I'm available for 26,000 for any...
You're the memory man. Come on.
You are a repository, a repository.
One aspect.
Not a suppository, you understand, but a repository.
That's an important one for yourself, Tessa, to actually bear in mind.
For all the good it did be, it might
okay.
be a lot of stuff.
Noted.
Exactly. Never get the two confused, ne'er the twain should meet.
Indeed.
One of the points you make in How's That, the Six Sixers Ball Mystery, with respect to the finance, is how clearly the Russian oligarch who decided he was furious at the 1.7 million he paid for a work of art.
Yes.
Obviously got recompense, but 26,000 is chump change, really.
This is really the problem. And also, just to fill in with Phil, this
see,
cricket
see
ball.
See what you did there, David? Very nice. It's Graham, Lord.
It was sold for £26,400 on the say so of Gary Sobers, the man who hit the ball, because he signed the famous Certificate of Provenance. And when I was writing the book, How's That, the Six Sixes Ball Mystery, I was trying to find out what happens when there's such a blatant mistake that's been made. And you mentioned that that painting that the Russian, I can't remember his name now, but he was very unhappy, and he went through the courts, and he won eventually. But £26,400 is small beer compared with that. Plus the fact that that Christie's no longer sells sporting memorabilia. They closed down their department in, I think, about 2007, and then the South Kensington sale room has closed as well. So I don't know.
I mean,
and they did all that without batting an eyelid. I was a little bit of levity at the end of the
day. We mustn't get too serious about it. But it is. I think the problem I've got, Phil, is that the ball that was sold was made by Stuart Surridge, was made by Duke and Son, and the ball that was bowled by Malcolm Nash to Gary Sobers was made by Stuart Surridge. And I've got all the evidence. And this, to me, is just a blatant case. It's so obvious. It's so wrong because it's the wrong ball.
I know, well, I mean, this is duplicity at its least sporting, I would have said.
Yeah, and it's the old cliche, but it's just not cricket. What happened to that cricket ball?
It isn't. It's just not cricket.
And
somebody's made a ball somewhere.
Absolutely. So. Yeah,
we'll have to draw a discreet veil over that
Was clearly the notion of the chap who was actually up for getting his century when a no ball was balled. Was that cricket? Because it was a big
This was outrageous, wasn't it? Playing in Somerset, and he was on 95 or something, and then just as he was about to score his century, the bowler threw the ball right over the...
He threw an impossible ball.
Yeah, right over the boundary, and he's now been suspended for for 9 games. But that's just not cricket again. Crazy.
Brexit, it's not cricket. It's not. We best not go there.
Let's not get onto that one.
Tessa, have you got any questions? Yes. In fact, before we actually go there, perhaps we'd like to find out, Phil, what are your sleeping habits like?
Pardon?
What are your sleeping habits like? Are you a regular sleeper? Are you asleep? Are you somebody
else? Well, I do. I try to do it every night as often as I can. Yes, I'm a fairly late bird, put it that way. Okay. I don't go to bed until pretty late. Very late, usually. And because that gives me a chance to read and to catch up on stuff. And I do tend to read quite a lot. Anyway, that's beside the point. But then I don't wait till I wake at usual sort of time. But I don't get huge amounts of sleep. I suppose about 6.5 to 7 hours a night, something like that. I don't really have much difficulty in getting off to sleep, except when it's very, very hot, when the weather's very hot.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, yeah, pretty good, pretty good.
The ultimate question is, do you think Phil Hurdwood might benefit from the light box, which you... recently won from the Sleepyhead Clinic with Stephanie Romashevsky.
Is this one of these SAD light boxes?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's called a Lumi, a Lumi body clock. And it's basically got sort of sunset and sunrise settings. And you can set the times that you wake up in the morning, and it's sort of the sun rises. Yeah, it's amazing, really. So it helps with seasonal affective disorder and winter blues.
It supercharges your biorhythms and your sort of
circadian
rhythms.
your circadian rhythms and your diurnal kind of, and there's a, you know, what's the stuff that you manufacture in your body? With
melatonin.
That's the one.
And serotonin. Yes.
Serotonin, exactly.
Yeah, it's supposed to help you wake naturally as well. So.
And is it working, Tessa?
It is. I mean, I've only used it, I think, I've only had it, what, two nights. So, you know, I'm getting used to it. But it's
early days,
as well. Yeah, it's very soothing. And it looks lovely as well.
So at night time, what does it do at night time? It's not really designed for night time, obviously.
You can have a sunset, so you can set it.
Oh,
and it's a really sort of a red light, like the sunset. You can set it for 20 minutes, half an hour, sort of, as long as you like.
Lovely. Yeah, well, of course, the thing is that people, you know, this whole business of actually sort of going to sleep and then having 8 hours and then waking up, is something which is, you know, kind of a little bit in debate, isn't it, really? Because it used to be that people used to wake up in the middle of the night. They'd have their first sleep.
Yep.
Then they'd wake up and go and see the neighbours, maybe write a letter, you know, go and tend to the animals if the chickens were, you know, creating a fuss. And then they'd go back to bed and have their second sleep. Well, I can sort of understand that, really, you know. And I suppose you could say the siesta is a kind of a weird kind of day, you know, daytime kind of extension of that, in a way.
So true. And it's reached the stage now where, with a matter of moments left, we've already had the Trump poem, which was obviously co-hosted with myself. But now it's time to put the spotlight fully onto Graham, with, of course, Phil Herdwood and our listener paying attention, as indeed you do with good self, Tessa, because this is quite a heartfelt poem that you're going to read now. It's all to do with the birth of your grandchild, I believe.
Ah, yes. This is the one that...
Tessa was almost in tears.
You're in for a treat.
So are you ready for this?
I'll tell you what this is.
I'm very much looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah, I wrote this after meeting my father, who was very ill, and then meeting my first grandchild, who was very young and very well. And it involves Trump and it involves Brexit. But it was just a moment that came to me, and I hope you like it. It's called The Sweetest of Smiles, or otherwise known as A Pause in the Poison. A very old man and a very young girl, one flag flying frailly, one just unfurled. He lay serene in a hospital bed, her cot was waiting for a small sleepy head. As I entered his room, he opened his eyes. I ended her crawl with a lift to the sky. Related but distant, in their own special way, with the slightest of signs, they both made my day. In this angry new world, full of false truths and fear, came a pause in the poison, a rare chance to cheer. A Trump to Trump's tweeting from his gold-plated pile, to the Brexiteers bleating about this sceptred isle, to the hate-mongers heating up tension so vile, those magical greetings briefly banished the bile. Two faces, two meetings, two sweetest of smiles, spontaneous and fleeting, made life more worthwhile.
Well, indeed, that's really lovely, and I wholeheartedly agree with the sentiment.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, a child's smile and the look of an aged parent is worth more. You know, for us to invest our hearts and our minds into than all the division and hatred and all the rest of it. There's abundant right now, and the division and everything, which is so depressing. And one could kind of stand up on a soapbox and start thumping the table, but when it comes to it, you know, a little baby is, it brings a tear to your eyes.
It really was that moment. I went to see my father in hospital, and I just opened the door, and he looked towards me, and he smiled at me, and he'd never done that in all my years. And then I went to see my granddaughter, and I picked her up the floor, and she gave me the most beautiful smile. And I just thought I need to write something about that. But
well, I can imagine that both of those things together would move you to actually write something and to express it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Phil. Thank you.
And that is why I have tagged both Graham, Tessa, and yourself, Phil Herdwood, if you find yourself being tagged on Facebook in a little shot from the studio this very day.
We coordinate pretty well. Look at our colours, our pastel colours.
It was designed, actually, because as you're well aware, Phil, I've always, even back in the day in 1980, '80s and the 20th century always insisted that our co-presenters have actually had colour-coordinated clothes. Matching clothes.
And colour-coordinated soft drinks and sweets, if I remember. Was it biscuits? What biscuits were they? I've forgotten.
We've gone on from those things. It's a case of we get a coffee from a machine now and hopefully sort of wander across the road for the whole thing. There's occasionally sort of an after-show coffee. Who knows? We do know that we will be going off to support Graham when he's next. Live in performance in a little place just outside Nottingham called Kimberley.
Yes, it's on Thursday, the 30th of August. And the reason I'm doing this particular talk, come one-man show on my book, Six Sixes, is because the man who was standing at the other end 50 years ago is a man called John Parkin, and he's from Kimberley. And over the last 12 years, I've got to know him really well. He's been very supportive of my investigation into the Six Sixes Ball mystery. And we're doing it almost as a sort of farewell performance because he's now in his 70s. But we're doing it at his local cricket club. And we're also getting a couple of the other Nottinghamshire players who were on the field when Sobers hit the Six Sixes to come along, and I'll be interviewing them. So it promises to be a really...
If the Snart family can't get us, I think we'll be there.
My dad would love this. Well, the whole family would. So.
How about that? Yeah. My goodness.
Outrageously wonderful. The day before, actually, Phil Hurdwood, Graham will be on Test Match Special.
No, it's the day after.
Oh, the day after.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, Phil, I've managed to get an invitation. I just sent them some material about the fact that the ball that was sold is not the ball bowled, and they've asked me to come on to Test Match Special. It's the fourth test, the second day of the fourth test, down at the Aegeus Bowl down in Southampton. I don't know how long I'm going to get, whether it's 5 minutes or 25 minutes.
You've been supported by Sir Tim Rice, Geoffrey Archer, Theresa May, our very own Prime Minister, and three other fine souls whose name have eluded me. But, you know, it's going to work.
I am looking forward to it because it's one of those things, Phil, you probably listen to it as well. It's one of those things that I've grown up with, and I'm really chuffed to have the opportunity to go on it and talk about
this. It's a real feather in your cap. Fantastic. And it's a great story, too.
It is indeed. And Phil Hurdwood, it's up to you to put those last two questions as senior head boy co-presenter to Tessa and indeed to Graham Lloyd on a show which actually started off with John Crudgington, head of health and physical wellbeing at Health for Heroes, William Coles travelling on train through tunnels on the way to London, Malcolm Tomlinson discussing his upcoming performance of art in East Riding, Kira Allsbrook, something to do with buses and dogs that weren't dogs. Most peculiar. Listen again to the podcast. Angela Rippon, of course, being Angela Rippon. What more can you say? Randy Reinholtz and Jean Bruce Scott from San Diego, a cricket side in San Diego. It could happen. And, of course, your good self, Phil Hurdwood. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today, Phil?
Always do. I mean, when do I not?
Oh, I don't know.
Good heavens.
Jim, you might
be lying. I will conclude by asking the assorted folks in the studio, did you enjoy it? You see, you know. Did you enjoy? You enjoyed your time. And if asked, if Alexius asked you, would you come back again?
Certainly would. It's my second time on this show, and I've always... Well, I've had two really...
Well, that's two for two, then, isn't
absolutely.
It, really?
I've had a great time.
Obviously, going to go for six, otherwise it's pointless, really.
I've had a great
fantastic.
Time. And Tessa?
Fantastic.
Almost
and one done. Of these days, Alexius is going to actually invite me up to the studio rather than doing a telephone link. He's been promising it for the last 5 years.
Yeah, but the problem
and
is...
I've been saying, you don't have to provide biscuits or Pfizer.
Yeah,
I will come for water or coffee and a couple of wagon wheels.
But they don't even pay your expenses, Phil. This is the worst thing about it.
No, I don't mind about that, but it's the wagon wheels I mean.
It'll happen. It will happen. You've been telling me before you'll come back. Okay, that's it. Tomorrow morning, a Midweek Drive audition. We're going to Space City Central with the very own astronaut training programme for the European Space Union, who actually joins.
Oh, I see. Well, that sounds
pretty good. That's Libby Jackson. She's the UK Space Agency's Human Space Flight and Microgravity Programme Manager. I know. William Sitwell's back with us. Rebecca Seals with us. Richard Fitzwilliams, Gabriella Peralta, Andy and Lennox. That's it. We're out of here. Great stuff coming through as far as the Siren Cinema show is concerned today. Thank you, Graham Lloyd. And thank you, Tessa Snott. And thank you, Phil Hurdwood. Thank you, dear listener. Keep on keeping on. Can we say bye-bye?
Goodbye.
Take care.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
We should really have said, how's that, shouldn't we? We'll do that again.
Yes, do that.
One,
we should
two,
indeed.
Three. How's that?
How's that?